Okay, so let's go to Book of Acts, chapter 21, verse 15. We're going to hope to go away to verse 35. It's actually not as dense as other passages in Acts because there's a lot of narratives here. So the topic for this morning is unjustly persecuted for the Lord. And you'll see how this topic relates to things that have been happening even this week. But let's go on. Unjustly persecuted for the Lord. So the first thing we're going to look at is the conflict warning that the Apostle Paul gets from verses 15 through 25. And then the second half, we'll see unjust persecution, verses 26 to 35. So let's start with verse 15. After these days, remember, Paul is where? He's coming from where? Where is he? You look a few verses before that. People are saying, don't go, right? You said it, right? Caesarea. No, he's in Caesarea. Don't go. This is going to happen to you. You're going to be put in chains. Basically, tell them you're going to die. Right? After these days, we got ready. This is Luke speaking as for them and went up to Jerusalem. So they take a 60-mile or so trip or journey. Probably took them about 2 to 3 days. Now, people say that when it says here, got ready, the word here means that they got animals ready. So it is possible that they were riding on animals as they went and made their journey to Jerusalem. I went up to Jerusalem. Some of the disciples from Caesarea also went with us and brought us to Nason. I don't know with the M and N. How would you pronounce that one? Huh? Nason? Let's see what the Greek is. The Greek is like that. So it is still Greek. I have no idea, right? Nason. I don't know how they pronounce it in Greek. So a Cypriot and an early disciple with whom they were to stay. When we reached Jerusalem, the brothers welcomed us gladly. Following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. After greeting them, he related in detail what God did among the Gentiles through his ministry. When they heard it, they glorified God and said, "You see, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are who have believed, and they're all zealous for the law. But they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to abandon Moses, by telling them not to circumcise their children or to walk in our customs. So what is it to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Therefore, do what we tell you. We have four men who have obligated themselves with a vow. Take these men, purify yourself along with them, and pay for them to get their heads shaved. Then everyone will know what they were told about you amounts to nothing, but that you yourself are also careful about observing the law. With regard to the Gentiles who have believed, we have written a letter containing our decision that they should keep themselves from food sacrificed to idols, from blood, from what is strangled, and from sexual immorality." We'll pause there and let's take this section. So Paul just arrived in Jerusalem, right? He doesn't meet immediately with either James or the church in Jerusalem, right? It takes a day. It's interesting because the first people that meet James is not Paul. It is actually Luke with probably a cohort of the people. It's the following day that Paul comes up with and talks to James. Now, why is James pointed out as the person or the apostle? Some people think the apostles are no longer there. They're all preaching the gospel. But a church obviously has a leadership structure, elders, and James is likely to be the lead elder or the chief elder, first among equals. Pretty much like we have in our church, we have Phil, who is the chairman of the elder board. So that's similar to what we have here. So he is the one representing the church. So they meet with him. And they report to the church in Jerusalem. They gave a very detailed report of what has happened. So Paul does that. He is accountable to the church, so he's giving that report. They expect that report. Now, they also notice that they also acknowledge that he actually has done a job that honors the Lord, right? After he shares this information on verse 20, he says, how many thousands of Jews there have believed and are zealous for the law. So there are a lot of people that came to Christ through Paul's ministry, no doubt. Notice that last phrase. It says what? But there were also some Jews who were what? zealous for that. Those people became believers. And they were zealous for the law even after being a believer. And that's important to note, because that's part of the basis of the conflict that we see Paul is having with the Jews. These men have become believers, but they're also still bound to the law, and they're still observing parts of the law. They know that it doesn't bring salvation, but they still are not letting things, some of those things, go. And just think about it. Some of us would say, well, we leave everything. But if you are in a culture where that has been your religion for so many years, part of your life since growing up, you don't just leave everything, right? It's not, it doesn't happen that way. So Paul, when he's preaching to the Jews and they become believers, they're still Jews. Same happened in Jerusalem. A lot of these believers are still believers and part of the Jewish culture. They still go to the temple to pray. That's what they meet, right? And so that's going to be the basis of some of the problems they have. So when they hear, the church hears this report, they what? What does it say in verse, what is it? 20? What did they do? When they heard it, they glorified God. So they're excited. They glorify God for the fruit that has been brought through the ministry that Paul has been led by the Lord. And they actually are glad. However, nothing is mentioned about the offering. Remember that offering? That's what Paul is actually coming with the offering for. And Luke does not mention it. Possible reasons why he's not mentioning it. One, this is what most commentators would say, is it failed to actually make any impact in Jerusalem. They really didn't even pay attention to it. They actually didn't think it was as noticeable, because Paul already was coming to Jerusalem. That was going to create conflict. And Paul coming with his offering to try to encourage the church didn't really work. Others think that Luke doesn't mention it because the focus is not really the offering, but it's Paul coming to Jerusalem and facing all the troubles that he will face from here on. And that's my take. I think that's pretty much what happens here. In verse 21, look at the rumors. What are the rumors that have been spreading as Paul is coming to Jerusalem? It is interesting to me that just one man, Paul, is causing all this, right? And they're following this guy wherever he goes. And some rumors have already been spreading in Jerusalem. What are the rumors? What is Paul doing according to them? Three things. One is, abandoning the law of Moses. He's teaching people, hey, you don't have to believe the law of Moses anymore. Number two, what else? Not to circumcise, right? Number three, yes, don't follow any customs. Now, were they true? None of them were true. Now, Paul, when he was preaching to the Gentiles, he told them clearly. Now, up to this point, Paul already written Romans, Galatians. So his focus on the gospel, aside from good works or any of the rituals, had been preached. I mean, Paul had been doing this with Gentiles, and Gentiles who came to Christ were not following that. That's obvious. And then you have all these Jews who came to Christ as well. They were still following the custom, but still Paul was not saying leave these things. But how do non-believers see it? They saw it as, oh no, he's teaching the opposite, right? He wants to destroy our Jewish religion. And it's also understandable because the Jews were also zealous, and they wanted to have more people believe in Judaism. And what was Paul doing when he preached the gospel? What was he doing when he preached the gospel? People believe. He's taking them from being Jews. Even the Gentiles who came to Christ, they're no longer going to follow Jewish customs. So they're losing proselytes, right? They're losing disciples. They're losing all these Jewish people. They don't want to do that. They're zealous. So those are the rumors. Paul wasn't doing this. Paul did teach that keeping customs such as circumcision, the law, was not necessary for salvation. And I'm not going to read the passages. I'll send you in the notes the passages in Galatians and 1 Corinthians. So that's the problem. Now, what is the resolution in verses 23 to 25 that they decide to do? What do they decide to do to kind of say, okay, this is what they're saying about you. Let's see how we can solve this. So they suggest what? Okay, but before that, he says in verse 23, it says, we tell you this, we have four men who have obligations with a vow. This is a Nazarite vow. This is found in Numbers chapter 6. A Nazarite vow. Do you remember what it was? Number 6?
No, I forgot
right? They would not, for a period of time, some of them was 30 days, they would not cut their hair, right? Let it go long. They would not eat and drink. They would not drink any wine. And at a certain period of time, in fact, 7 days, they would come to the temple and go through a purification ritual. I can't go through it because it will take us more time. Read it in Numbers chapter 6, verse 1 through 21. It's there. So these men, right, these Jewish men are doing this. Now, this is not for salvation. These guys are still part of the Jewish system, and they're still doing purification, right? They're still coming to the temple. So is Paul. Paul had already done this before. Remember when he cut his hair? He already done a Nazarite vow. Now, he's not doing a Nazarite vow here. These men are, right? Now, Paul is coming from being among the Gentiles. Can he just come in the temple? He can't. If he has been in contact with any Gentile, Jewish religion would tell him that he needs to purify himself before he could enter the temple. So he is going to purify himself for that period of time, for 7 days. He was going to purify himself and then be able to participate in the temple. Not only that, though, he is coming with these men who have a vow to pay, who have a vow to do and pay. And Paul will do what for them? He will come with them, but he also is going to do what? Pay their dues. They had to pay their dues. When you were not clean and you came to the temple and purify yourself, you had to pay a due, right? A fee. So Paul will do that. So the people that saw Paul would say, oh, there's Paul. He's bringing this. Oh, he believes. He still believes in this stuff. He believes in the Jewish customs and traditions. He's not opposed to it. So that's what they were expecting that would happen. But that's not what happens. It's actually worse than that. It totally backfires. Now, some people say this was not a good idea. Paul should not have done this. I think it was a very sensible idea, but it just didn't work. And the plans of God also, that was it just wouldn't go. Also, people argue, well, did Paul violate his own principles by doing this? By Paul coming in with these Jewish men and doing this ritual or participating in it and purifying, was he actually saying, I am bound to the law? Do you think that happened? Mm-hmm. Was Paul violating his conscience?
Nope.
And just following the advice of the leaders of the church? No. You know what Paul was doing? Why would Paul do it? Can you think of Paul, now that we've studied a lot in Book of Acts? Why would... Why, though? What's the reason? The gospel, right? Paul was a man focused on the gospel. What did he say in 1 Corinthians 9:20? Somebody read that. Paul knew the focus. He didn't care. Look, he says, look, if you circumcise, it means nothing. If you don't circumcise, it means nothing, right? If you eat meat, it doesn't matter. If you don't eat meat, it doesn't matter. So, to me, Paul was very practical, and at the same time, he had a focus. What is the focus? First Corinthians 9:20. So what was Paul's purpose? Is to share the gospel. If he could make himself like a Jew to share the gospel, which he's looking for in Jerusalem, he wants to share the gospel with them, with as many Jews as possible. And when he was with the Gentiles, he became like the Gentiles, right? And preached the gospel to the Gentiles. That was his whole purpose. So he was not violent. So what happens? Verse 26. Again, you see verse 25 before that, that they also mentioned that accord that they had made. Remember that in Acts chapter 15, when they had that big council on what should the Gentiles follow? They actually mention it here, not because it's a new topic, it's to say, this does not relate to the Gentiles. It relates to the Jews. With the Gentiles, we've already addressed this, that they need to follow this. So the issue here is not a Gentile issue. It's a Jew issue that needs to be dealt with, especially with Paul. Verse 26. So let's see what happens. The unjust persecution of Paul here, verses 26 to 35. The next day, Paul took the men, having purified along with them, and entered the temple, announcing the completion of purification days when the offering for each would be made. This was customary. So up to that point, Paul would go to whoever was in the temple. I don't know exactly who, but he would go and say, hey, my time is almost up, and I'm going to be purified. He went and announced that. He was ending that at the seventh day of that event. And what happens? Verse 27. As the 7 days were about to end, the Jews from Asia saw him in the temple complex, stirred up the whole crowd and seized him. Who are these Jews? He says they're from Asia. Well, they're probably from Ephesus. Remember those guys in Ephesus? What happened in Ephesus? Anyone recall? He got the mob. Remember all that mob that got created, and they started chanting, "Great is Athena of the Ephesians." Paul wasn't involved in the mob, but they wanted to get him, right? And instead, they had somebody else to grab. Well, these men who stirred up the crowd in Ephesus are now here, and they had seen Paul. If you look at verse 29, they had seen Paul with Trophimus. And so they're looking at Paul, and there is Paul, and they see Paul with a few men. So immediately they think, oh, that's Paul, and he's bringing Gentiles into the temple. And so they seize him. They took him. In verse 27, shouting, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who teaches everyone against our people, our law in this place. What's more, he also brought Greeks into the temple and has profaned his holy place." You know what they're saying? I mean, profaning the temple is worthy of death. This is a serious thing. "For they have previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian, in the city with him, and they suppose that Paul had brought him into the temple complex." Now, so this is unjustly persecution as far as Paul is concerned. Now, the Jews from Asia came down to incite people, right? They see him and they incite people. This is the sixth time that Paul has caused, in some way, a riot. Isn't that amazing? One man has done this, who's focused on the gospel. It's about the sixth time that we see it happen. Now, they assume that he is with Trophimus without any investigation. They assume that he's bringing Gentiles into the temple, where they are prohibited. The temple was divided into sections. The first part was the court of the Gentiles, and that's where people could come. That's the biggest area. Almost anyone could come in. The next part was the court of the women. The only women could come in who were Jewish. The next part was the court of men. And that's where all the Jewish men could come. Paul could enter that. And obviously then moves on to the inner part of the temple, which only the priest would come once a year. But Paul was in that area, in that court where he was allowed as a Jew. So they're thinking he's bringing in a Gentile into the temple. Okay? Because that's what they saw and they said. Now, let me read you a message they had as far as in the temple. This is a message they had as you enter the temple, in the complex. It said this: "No foreigner may enter within the barricade which surrounds the temple and enclosure. Anyone who is caught doing so will have himself to be blamed for what follows: death." And by the way, the Romans actually gave him authority to actually kill someone who would violate their sacredness, the sacredness of the temple. So we're going to read right now how they dragged Paul. They actually had Rome on their side. And so any Gentile who crossed over besides the area, the general temple area for the Gentiles, and wander in the temple, they would be caught and they would be executed by the Jewish leaders. And Rome sanctioned that. Rome gave them power as far as religion so that they would get something from them, support from them. So they had agreed upon that they, as far as religion, the Jews had a lot of control of it, a lot of control over that. All right, so let's go on. So not only these men accusing Paul of defiling the temple, which carry the sentence of death, but he says he's trying to destroy our Jewish religion, including the temple. By the way, he's doing it through his teaching. Isn't that silly? And by the way, Paul had come to the temple to do what? Purification, right? Does it make sense that they're saying he's coming in to defile the temple when Paul's coming in to purify himself? It's almost illogical, right? So let's get this straight. Paul's coming in to purify himself, but then they're accusing him of desecrating the temple, making it impure by bringing a Gentile, which really he wanted just to purify himself to be in the temple. Again, but they don't see that, right? They just see Paul as a threat. Those who don't believe the gospel see us as a threat, right? They hate to lose their converts. That's what we have nowadays, this conflict going on, right, in the Middle East. Right? Islam wants those converts. They don't want to lose converts. And they are angry, right? They want to do everything possible to convert people. And if it's necessary, it will be by force and intimidation. It will be by killing Christians and showing them and showing others that they need to believe in Islam. And this is not new at all, by the way, guys. This is not the first time it's happened, and it's not the first time we see the persecution of believers as well. It's happened all along, even here in the book of Acts. Now, verse 30. The Jews attempt to kill Paul, right? Verse 30, look at it. The whole city was stirred, and the people rushed together. They seized Paul, dragged him out of the temple complex, and at once the gates were shut. As they were trying to kill him, word went up to the commander of the regiment that all Jerusalem was in chaos. So what? They literally dragged him out of the temple complex, right? Shut the door to the entrance of that sacredness of the temple, right, where the Jews could go in, not the court area. And they were dragging him out. You know where we're dragging? Why they were dragging him out? To kill him. Yeah, they could not kill inside. Remember Stephen? What was Stephen? How was he killed? Yeah, and he was taken out of the temple area. So they're taking Paul, and they're going to drag him out and kill him. But at that time, somebody intervenes. There's a Roman commander who rescues Paul in verse 32. This guy is a commander who had a regiment. He was in charge of 1,000 people. And he takes a few people, a few of those centurions. So he takes about 200 soldiers. And he comes and gets Paul. Taking along soldiers and centurions, he immediately ran down with them, seeing the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came up, took him into custody, and ordered him to be bound with two chains, probably a soldier on each side. He asked who he was and what he had done. Some of them all were shouting one thing and some another. Since he was not able to get reliable information because of the uproar, he ordered him to be taken into the barracks. So now, the fortress was called Fortress Antonia. It was right next to the temple. So they actually observed what's happening in the temple. They saw this. This commander, whose name is Claudius Lysias, and we know this from Acts 23:26, comes down with 200 soldiers, grabs Paul, right? Rescues him. People are beating him. Now, think about it. What is Paul thinking? What do you think Paul is thinking? As they are beating him, do you think he's thinking, this is it, I'm dying, I'm going to die here?
No.
I don't think so. I knew that this is not, he knew that this was not his time yet. But as you're getting punched and beaten, as if you're going to get killed, what do you think Paul's thinking?
Probably just thinking, okay, this is my payback for what I did to Christians before.
Could be, but I don't think Paul thought that way and said, oh, I'm just getting paid. Paul is just taking it. He knows. He might have. But I think Paul was, hey, he had learned. He already got beaten several times, left for dead. He had been already beaten with rods, right? Rocks. Paul, he's just like, here goes another day for Jesus. Absolutely. Let me tell you, whenever there's persecution among believers, there's going to be growth. So Paul, I think, was expecting it. And while, even at that moment, he knows, this is not it. I'm still going to share the gospel. Because I have to speak among kings. That's what Acts 9:15 says. That the Lord had called him to speak not only among the Jews and Gentiles, but among kings. He hasn't done it yet. He will speak with Felix and some of the Roman leaders, and he will share the gospel. Now, Claudius tried to get information, couldn't get it because it's too many people shouting. Now, as he's taking it up the stairs, the barracks, he's trying to just lead him along. They can't because of the mob, so they literally have to carry Paul. So they're carrying him up the stairs to the barracks. That's incredible. That one man, because of the gospel, is causing such a pandemonium. Now, and what do they say at the end? They say, for the mass of the people follow, yelling what? Take him away. Do you know what that means? The same words used for Jesus. What does it mean? Get rid of him. Kill him. That's what they're saying. They don't. So we're going to stop there. But what do we learn from this passage? I mean, it's all about persecution, unjustly being persecuted. And we heard this morning about Paul saying that he didn't have any rights. Well, Paul actually does assert some of his legal rights. He will ask for Roman to intervene and actually judge him as a Roman. He actually uses his citizenship to assert his right as a citizen. So that is not wrong to assert your rights as a citizen. In fact, it was all strategic for him because he knew that would give him an opportunity to present the gospel to the government. But here's what we learned. Three things. Number one, believers should expect false accusations and unjust persecution. Matthew 5:10-12, Jesus said this, that we can expect that. Blessed, he said, you will be when people persecute, revile you, and say all kinds of bad things falsely about you, he said. Rejoice, because your reward in heaven is great. That's what he said in Matthew 5:10-12. John 15:20-21, he also said that we are not of this world, he says, and because you are my followers, you can expect false accusations and unjust persecution. Number two, believers should understand that the world is not their home. 1 Peter 2:11 says that we are pilgrims, and Hebrews 11:13 says the following: they all die in faith, all the martyrs of the faith, without having received the promises, but they saw them from a distance, greeted them, and confessed that they were foreigners and temporary residents on earth. Believers should understand that the world is not our home, right? And so Paul knew that. I was just beginning to read a book that came out, and I'm probably not going to finish it in a while, but it's by David Platt. He's the man who's in charge of the Southern Baptist, the foreign mission organization, and he wrote a book called Counterculture just recently. He says this: if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me, quoting Luke 9:23. But he says this, talk about countercultural. In a world where everything revolves around yourself, protect yourself, promote yourself, comfort yourself, take care of yourself, Jesus says, crucify yourself. Put aside self-preservation in order to live for God's glorification, no matter what that means for you in the culture around you. So that's what he says. Right? Jesus says, crucify. Jesus didn't say, protect. Was Paul concerned about his protection? To a degree, when he was sensible, right? Yes. But ultimately, is Paul worried about his self-preservation? No. He is ready to die if necessary for Christ. And so as believers, we should understand that the world is not our home. It's not where we're going to be forever. So, and that should help us understand persecution. Number three, believers should be steadfast in proclaiming the gospel in spite of the cost. 1 Corinthians 4, Paul talks a lot about what he has suffered, but he says we do it for the gospel. 2 Corinthians 4 also, you can read those chapters at home. But the mission of sharing the gospel is for all of us, no matter what our job is. We're called to be God's witnesses. And that word witness, you know what the real word for that word witness is? You probably heard it before. What is it? You know? It's martyr. The word martyr is the same. It's the word used in the Bible for a witness. So a martyr is somebody who gives his life for the Lord, and it means that he loses his life for him. And this week, we've seen it, right? We've seen people who have been unjustly persecuted, who have given their life, right? And we also see the Apostle Paul suffering here. And it won't get better for him, at least temporarily, then things will get better for him and he will have an opportunity to share the gospel. But I think we need to understand that persecution is something that we can expect, and we should continue to be focused on sharing the gospel. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said this about persecution. Dietrich Bonhoeffer is a man who was a Lutheran during World War II. The church in Germany, the main church, evangelical church, all catered to Adolf Hitler. They were bending the knee to him. But Dietrich Bonhoeffer became part of what is called a confessing church. The confessing church decided, no, we're not gonna stand for this. We're going to proclaim that this is wrong. And eventually he actually joins a group of people who are committed to assassinate Adolf Hitler. But he is caught. He is imprisoned. And then he's hanged for the cause. But this is what he wrote about persecution and about giving our life for Christ. As Jesus says that every Christian has his own cross waiting for him. A cross destined and appointed by God. Each must endure his allotted share of suffering and rejection. But each has a different share. Some God deems worthy of the highest form of suffering and gives them the grace of martyrdom, while others he does not allow to be tempted above that they are able to bear. But it is the one and the same cross in every case. And then he goes on and says, discipleship means allegiance to the suffering Christ. And it is therefore not all surprising that Christians should be called upon to suffer. In fact, it is a joy and a token of his grace. Interesting that he would say. So it is a privilege to suffer. And he says those who give their life for Christ, they get special privilege because they're actually are given that part where they actually join with Christ as well. So that is for us to think about as well, that we will experience all of that. Let's pray.